Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Two major European football associations called on FIFA's president to resign ahead of presidential elections planned for Friday. The president of the Union of European Football Associations, a French football legend, Michel Platini, spoke openly about the FIFA scandal and took issue with FIFA president Sepp Blatter's refusal to resign. Meanwhile, the German Football Association has also demanded Blatter's resignation, citing the credibility issue with him. Meanwhile, Blatter spoke to reporters today. Only two candidates are running for the FIFA presidency. The current president, Blatter, is standing in for a fifth term as FIFA president, and Prince Ali bin al-Hussein of Jordan. The leader of Al-Qaeda Syria branch in the group says is focused on defeating President Bashar al-Assad and not on launching attacks against Western countries. In an interview Wednesday with Al Jazeera, Nusra Front Chief Abu Mohammed al-Ghalani said it won't be long before Mr. Assad government falls. He also criticized the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which has sent fighters to bolster Syrian forces, saying the militants knew their fate when they joined with Mr. Assad. Iran's foreign minister says he is hopeful that Iran and a group of world powers can reach a final agreement on Tehran's nuclear program within a reasonable period of time. However, Mohammad Javad Zarif also said during a visit to Greece Thursday that there will be no agreement if there are excessive demands by other nations involved in those negotiations. The two sides agreed in April to a framework outline of an accord. VOA News. Burundi's Catholic Church says it's withdrawing its support of the country's upcoming elections after weeks of political unrest. Burundi's Catholic bishops released a statement Thursday saying it's asking its clergy who serve on electoral commissions to step down from those commissions. Meanwhile, the European Union is suspending its election observer mission in Burundi. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter Wednesday said the United States will be the primary security power in the Asia-Pacific region for years, and he demanded China immediately stop island building in the South China Sea. Carter said during a visit to Pearl Harbor that all countries in Asia, including China, must stop militarizing their dispute over an island chain and settle it peacefully. Carter added that the U.S. will fly, sail, and operate whatever international law allows. China has been reclaiming land and building artificial islands in the Spratlys, including China, Malaysia, and Vietnam, who claim sovereignty. Over two dozen people are undergoing precautionary treatment for anthrax after the U.S. military accidentally shipped live samples of the deadly bacteria to civilian commercial labs in 9 states and a military lab in South Korea. Officials say 4 laboratory workers in the United States, along with 22 personnel at Osan Air Force Base outside of Seoul, may have been exposed to that anthrax. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said Thursday that defense officials are looking at ways to enhance efforts to train and equip pro-government forces in Iraq as they battle Islamic State fighters. Speaking to reporters traveling with him on a trip to Asia, Carter said recent events in Iraq, where the militants seized the provincial capital of Anbar province west of Baghdad, have shown the need for a capable ground partner. Pakistan has reaffirmed its support for efforts aimed at promoting peace and stability in Afghanistan, saying it is committed to enhancing relations with the neighboring country. The statement follows increased Taliban attacks and reports that Afghan peace envoys held secret talks with the insurgent group last week. Malaysia's deputy home affairs minister says the government believes 139 people are buried in a group of graves discovered in a remote location on the country's border with Thailand. The minister told reporters Thursday that investigators believe there is one body in each of the graves discovered rather than multiples, as was first suspected. He says each of the bodies are suspected to be linked to human traffickers. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan is facing the worst levels of food insecurity. The young country has faced since independence because of conflict, high food prices, and a worsening economic crisis.
That's World Food Program spokesman George Fominien commenting on growing hunger in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Muhammadu Buhari is taking office as president of Nigeria tomorrow, and the European Union has suspended its observer mission to the elections in Burundi.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Muhammadu Buhari is taking office as president of Nigeria tomorrow, and people across Africa's most populous nation have high expectations for their new president. Chris Stein has more from our regional bureau in Dakar.
When the pomp and circumstance of the inauguration ends in the capital, Abuja, Mr. Buhari will sit down to the hard task of governing Nigeria. The country is just starting to recover from a fuel shortage that crippled businesses nationwide. Strong oil production is offset by the low price of crude and the loss of billions of dollars to the economy. Meanwhile, more than 1 million people have fled the country's northeast to escape the Boko Haram insurgency, which, despite recent military advances, continues to threaten the region. Mr. Buhari outlined his priorities after his March election, tackling corruption, insecurity, and employment. The former military ruler has his detractors, but many Nigerians are nonetheless hopeful the next 4 years will see improvements in Africa's largest economy. In the southern Niger Delta town of Ugeli, civil servant Samson Onorietti says he thinks Mr. Buhari has what it takes to reform the country's oil sector, which is riddled with allegations of waste and corruption.
He has the guts, but you know what? Nobody can predict a leader until he has his phone.
Up north in the city of Kaduna, Suleiman Yakubu says Mr. Buhari should prosecute corrupt politicians from outgoing President Goodluck Jonathan's government.
Corruption has eaten deep, which I'm sure will make the country to be stagnant. He must bring some people on, bring people back, those who the outgoing government, bring them back so that they answer or bring our money they've stolen.
Kaduna resident Faith Fatima says she wishes simply for a government that is honest and accountable.
I expect this government to be truthful, to also be accountable to the masses who have elected them, not their self-centered interest of political empowerment, but they must know that Nigeria is rich enough to take care of its populace, and they should make sure they obey the rule of law.
But when it comes to corruption, Fatima says she is not so sure Mr. Buhari can solve it from his office in Abuja's Aso Rock presidential villa.
For us to handle corruption as a nation is a collective responsibility, because we are all responsible for the state that our country has found ourselves.
In theory, Buhari has enormous tools at his disposal to accomplish his agenda. His party controls both houses of the National Assembly and has a majority of governorships. But much political power rests in the hands of vested interests and power brokers, and Buhari must struggle with them to bring Nigerians the change he promised. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
A new survey shows what problems Nigerians want the new president to tackle when he takes office. Afrobarometer lists the top issues as unemployment, a reliable electricity supply, crime, security, and poverty. Unemployment has been number one among citizens' concerns in all five rounds of Afrobarometer surveys conducted since 2003. The issue was always cited by about half of the survey respondents. Electricity, crime, and security have been rising rapidly as citizens' priorities.
It's now estimated that 40% of South Sudan's population, or 4.6 million people, now face acute hunger in the next 3 months. The World Food Program says food insecurity is growing worse both in conflict and non-conflict areas. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The WFP says hunger is reaching record levels in South Sudan. Spokesman George Fominien says a combination of problems is to blame.
South Sudan is facing the worst levels of food insecurity the young country has faced since independence because of conflict, high food prices, and a worsening economic crisis.
The warning follows the release of the latest integrated food security phase classification analysis. The IPC is a scale that weighs food security, nutrition, and livelihood data to determine the severity of a food crisis. It was first developed for Somalia. It says that unrelenting conflict and the onset of the lean season, when food needs are the highest, are intensifying alarming levels of hunger in much of the country.
The latest analysis shows that the bulk of these people who are facing these high levels of food insecurity in the conflict-affected states of the Greater Upper Nile. We're talking about Unity, Upper Nile State, and Jonglei State.
Conflict is also making food insecurity worse in northern Bahr el Ghazal and Warrap states. Aid agencies are using airdrops, boats, food distributions, and cash vouchers to try to deal with the situation.
The World Food Program and its partners have been working flat out for months now, trying to ensure that we can provide food assistance to those who are in need. And we are continuing in this way. In the conflict-affected areas, we've been ensuring a regular supply of life-saving food assistance through our rapid response missions in particular.
Fominion says despite the efforts, humanitarian workers are having a harder time reaching those in need.
The renewed hostilities and the increased insecurity and intensifying harassment of humanitarian workers means that we are facing what we call shrinking humanitarian space available for us to work.
The World Food Program says it's facing a $230 million shortfall over the next 6 months. But even if the money is received, can aid agencies overcome the obstacles they face?
That's a very good question, because South Sudan is a very challenging area for humanitarian operations because of infrastructure difficulties which we face. The logistics operation here is quite heavy. If we don't have money in good time, we may not be able to procure in time. And once you're not able to procure in time, it becomes even much more complicated to move the food into the country.
He says the rainy season has begun, and in the coming months, many parts of the country will become inaccessible by road. Transporting supplies by truck is the cheapest method. Airdrops are the most expensive. Fominion says a return to peace is essential, not only for humanitarian operations, but for people to return to their livelihoods. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The European Union has suspended its observer mission to the elections in Burundi. EU's foreign policy head says its observers cannot fulfill their mission in a climate of media curbs and intimidation of opposition. And meanwhile, Burundi's Catholic Church says it is withdrawing its support of the country's upcoming elections after weeks of political unrest. Burundi's Catholic bishops released a statement today saying it is asking its clergy, who serve on electoral commissions, to step down from those commissions. Yesterday, Burundi's government asked Burundians to donate the money needed to hold elections in June. Some foreign donors have threatened to withhold foreign aid if President Pierre Nkurunziza continues with his controversial plan to run for a third term. The president's announcement late last month sparked weeks of political protests that have turned violent, leading to more than 20 deaths and nearly 500 injuries in clashes between protesters and police. Earlier this month, some of the president's critics stayed an unsuccessful coup while he was out of the country. So far, Mr. Nkurunziza has refused to postpone the elections, as his critics, including the Catholic Church, have demanded.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhi, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Muhammadu Buhari is taking office as president of Nigeria tomorrow. And the European Union has suspended its observer mission to the elections in Burundi. And food insecurity is growing worse, both in conflict and non-conflict areas in South Sudan. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, has closed two of its health posts in the Dadaab camp, located in northeastern Kenya, due to deteriorating security conditions. The refugee camp is the largest of its kind in the world, housing some 350,000 people, mostly from Somalia. In addition, the group has evacuated 42 of its health staff from the camps to Nairobi. They say violence and threats of violence in Kenya's northeastern province have escalated, and the evacuation is a precautionary measure. However, the move has already had a direct impact on MSF's ability to provide much-needed medical care to the refugees in Dadaab. Abubakar Mohammed is the humanitarian affairs officer for MSF in Dadaab. He spoke with me about the present situation and challenges in maintaining medical services for people at the camp.
It is just part of precautionary measures that MSF decided to take as a result of violence and threats in the northeastern province of Kenya that escalated recently. MSF, the Doctors Without Borders, have evacuated 42 of his staff, and this will have a huge impact on his operations in Dadaab.
What kind of an impact is this closure having on the work that you all are doing there?
MSF has been providing primary and secondary health care to refugees living in the Dagale refugee camp, plus host community population living in the surrounding environment.
So right now you all are operating a 100-bed hospital. How is that being affected with 42 of your health staff have been moved to Nairobi?
What we have done is to actually reorganize our hospital and the health post. We have closed two health posts and then redeployed some of the staff who are working in those health posts to cover gaps left behind by the staff. So the hospital, as we speak, is fully covered and operational.
You all are also calling on the armed groups to guarantee respect for your medical facilities, for patients, and for staff. So who are you referring to with this call?
I think in the environment like that, which is dynamic, and you do not know which group is violating the rights of the other, then I think we're just appealing to all those actors in the environment to respect this kind of humanitarian rule.
How long do you think that you will have these two health posts suspended?
Well, it will depend because MSF is undertaking and evaluating threat and risk analysis. And as soon as this is concluded and vulnerability and closed, then I think there will be possibility of reopening those health posts.
Is there any violence taking place right now at the camp?
No, there's no willing person or organization willing to undertake the running of those closed health posts. And I think there have been a lot of difficulties for quite some time in these refugee camps because there have been donor fatigue and many of the services have scaled down. So there are less enthusiasm of organization working in this setup. So even if MSF will be willing to hand over this operation to any other organization, I don't think it will be easy to find anyone willing to come and deliver.
As far as the actual activities at the hospital, how are you all handling, for instance, deliveries of babies at this point?
Well, our maternity is fully operational. We have 9 qualified midwives. We have a doctor in charge of reproductive health in maternity. We have an emergency cesarean section prepared in the event of a mother failing to deliver. So we are fully prepared for any obstetric emergencies.
Abubakar Mohammed is the humanitarian affairs officer for MSF. He spoke with me from the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya.
The UN Secretary General says he is skeptical of European Union plans to fight the flow of migrants by destroying smugglers' boat off the coast of Libya. This as EU anti-smuggling vessels sail closer to the Libyan coast. Today, the head of the EU border agency Frontex said patrol boats and aircrafts are now within 80 nautical miles of the shore. Fabre Legri told the Associated Press wire service they will enter Libya's territorial waters only to save lives. The head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, visited the offices of the European Union yesterday. He urged the EU to give greater priority to strengthening life-saving operations and expanding search and rescue strategies. He criticized as limited a Security Council resolution asking the UN for legal backing for the taking of smuggler vessels. Interior ministers of EU member states are to meet and discuss the refugee plan on June 15th and 16th in Luxembourg. They can still veto the proposal. Several European countries have said they are opposed to a quota system in the EU refugee relocation plan. It requires member states to receive specific numbers of refugees based on economic strength, unemployment rates, and other factors. Of the 40,000 refugees who land in Italy and Greece, the highest numbers would go to Germany, France, and Spain. More than 80,000 have landed in Europe so far this year.
Sponsors are calling for football's governing body, FIFA, to make changes. This while its regional federations debate the future of its often criticized leader after the United States and Switzerland unveiled major corruption investigations. Credit card company Visa made the strongest statement after the U.S. Justice Department unveiled an indictment yesterday, charging 14 people with offenses that include racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. Visa expressed profound disappointment and said that without reforms, the company would reassess its sponsorship of FIFA. A statement issued by Visa said that as a sponsor, it expects FIFA to take swift and immediate steps to address these issues. Coca-Cola also said it has repeatedly expressed concern about the allegations and expects FIFA to thoroughly address the matter, while Adidas called on FIFA to follow transparent compliance standards in everything it does. Meanwhile, the Asian Football Confederation said today that Friday's scheduled vote for FIFA's president should go ahead as planned and that it supports current president Sepp Blatter. He is trying to win a fifth term with Jordan's Prince Ali bin al-Hussein as his opposition. The European Federation, UEFA, called for the election to be postponed for 6 months, saying there is a strong need for a change to the leadership of FIFA. Blatter is not among the nine current and former top FIFA officials charged yesterday. He issued his own statement vowing that those involved in misconduct will be put out of the game.
Conservationists say the elephant population in Mozambique has shrunk nearly 50% in the past 5 years because of poaching, even as it grows elsewhere. The U.S.-based Wildlife Conservation Society reported this week that the number of elephants in Mozambique totals only about 10,300 today, compared to more than 20,000 5 years ago. It blames ivory poachers for the slaughter of the African elephants, mainly to meet the ivory demand in China. The Conservation Society says it does its elephant surveys with aerial photographs. Meanwhile, it says the number of elephants in Uganda has increased dramatically over the past few decades because of anti-poaching protections. The society says Uganda had only 700 to 800 elephants left in the 1980s, but more than 5,000 living in wildlife reserves now. Elephant population are tracked by a project began by Microsoft founder Paul G. Allen called the Great Elephant Census. It is operated by a group called Elephants Without Borders.
African road experts are meeting in Cameroon to discuss potential road networks that would link the major markets of the continent. One such road is being built in West Africa, linking the Cameroonian town of Bamenda and the Nigerian town of Enugu. Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Yaoundé.
34-year-old Enotambe clears his cassava farm in Numba Village in northwestern Cameroon. The University of Yaoundé graduate moved to the village and opened a cassava farm after a portion of the Bamenda Enugu Road opened in the area 3 years ago.
After the road was constructed, I discovered that so many people were coming from Nigeria to buy food and vegetables. They also came to sell cosmetic products. So I opened this farm to grow and sell in Nigeria. And I must tell you, there is a market there that I find difficult to produce enough for them.
Tambe's wife, Elvira, has also opened a farm where she grows vegetables for the Nigerian market. Elvira has recruited 3 people that she pays $35 each week to work on her farm.
I pay for workers to clear, to till, but I also do some work like planting and weeding. It costs almost 70,000 francs for the expenditure, but I'm able to have that twice or more than.
The Enugu-Bamenda Highway, still under construction, is part of the Trans-African Highway, conceived more than 30 years ago as a transcontinental link from Lagos, Nigeria, on the Atlantic Ocean to Mombasa, Kenya, on the Indian Ocean. Upon completion, the road will also link landlocked sub-Saharan African countries. Don Hogben of the World Road Association says such initiatives should be encouraged so poverty can be eradicated in rural parts of Africa through job creation and better access to markets.
The transport of goods is a global problem. It is so important to the economies of nations, whether they're developed countries in Europe or Australia or whether they're countries in Africa. The transport of goods has to be done safely, it has to be done efficiently for the good of all the people. And I think a really important part of that is not only that drivers and companies operate safely, but the road system also has to be of a very good quality and suitable for the vehicles that are in use. The opportunity from better roads is very, very high, and I'm sure there's similar opportunities right across Africa.
Nigeria and Cameroon signed a memorandum of understanding 7 years ago to build the Enugu to Bamenda Road and promote socioeconomic development and integration. It is funded by the African Development Bank. Its total cost is $423 million. 203 kilometers of the 443 kilometers of road on Cameroon territory has been completed. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The sounds of Africa, today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Food insecurity is growing worse both in conflict and non-conflict areas in South Sudan. And Burundi's Catholic Church says it is withdrawing its support of the country's upcoming elections after weeks of political unrest. Coming up, music from Rwanda and in our feature segment, what the recent riots mean to residents of the U.S. city of Baltimore. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have an update for us on world football's top official.
Kim, embattled FIFA president Sepp Blatter held an emergency meeting Thursday with top officials of world football's governing body in the wake of a big corruption scandal. The U.S. Justice Department formally charged 14 men, including 9 FIFA officials, with racketeering, bribery, fraud, and money laundering, totaling more than $150 million. The charges related to 3 World Cup tournaments, the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, the 2018 World Cup in Russia, and the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. After the emergency meeting, the 79-year-old Blatter met with UEFA football chief Michel Platini, who urged the FIFA boss to resign. Blatter said he would not step down. The English Football Association chairman Greg Dyke also called on Blatter to resign.
My position, the FA's position, hasn't changed. We still think that what has got to happen is FIFA have got to be rid of Blatter. I mean, Mr. Blatter, whether he is involved in any of these shenanigans or not is irrelevant. He is the person who has led FIFA for 16 years, and now we look at the results, and he must take responsibility.
The calls for Blatter to resign came on the eve of him running for a 5th term in FIFA presidential elections. The European governing body, UEFA, had threatened to boycott the election, but now it appears it will participate. Most UEFA countries are backing Prince Ali bin al-Hussein of Jordan, Blatter's only challenger. Meanwhile, South Africa is reeling in the wake of a U.S. indictment that says officials bribed the World Football Organization, FIFA, to secure the 2010 World Cup. The country's sports ministry is denying it made any payments. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
That was the sound of South Africa's 2010 World Cup, the insistent buzz of the now famous Vuvuzela. But South African officials have made little noise at all in response to the U.S. indictment that asserts, among other things, that South Africa bribed FIFA officials to host that historic tournament. The charges by U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch led to the arrest Wednesday of 14 FIFA officials and executives who were accused of collectively taking more than $150 million in bribes. Lynch's 164-page indictment outlines a scenario in which former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner sent an intermediary to Paris to collect a briefcase stuffed with dollars from a South African official. The indictment does not single out any South African by name. When contacted by VOA seeking comment on the indictment, South African presidential spokesman Harold Moloka passed the ball to the sports ministry. Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula says, according to official records, no such payment came from the ministry or the government.
Our financial records and books for the 2010 and 11 financial years and those before and after the period of the World Cup have been audited by the Auditor General of South Africa, and no such amount has been found on our books.
South Africa's top opposition party has already turned the scandal into a political football. The Democratic Alliance's shadow minister of sports is Soli Malatsi, who is quick to criticize the man who is widely thought to be at the center of these sideline deals, Danny Jordan, the head of the local organizing committee for the 2010 World Cup.
These vaccine allegations, you know, they are serious allegations which should be probed. You know, they cannot be swept under the carpet. So what we will be doing as the official opposition is that today we have written a letter to the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Sport and Recreation, asking her to immediately summon SAFA under the leadership of Dr. Denis Jordan to the Portfolio Committee to provide an explanation on these allegations.
He said the party believes a bribe to FIFA could not have been paid without the knowledge of senior officials on South Africa's bid committee. Jordan was recently named executive mayor of the Nelson Mandela Bay metropolitan area by the ruling African National Congress. He was due to be endorsed Thursday. Calls to the mayor's office went unanswered. The revelations are especially disheartening to South Africans who thought that the first ever World Cup on African soil was the product of so-called Madiba magic. Madiba is the clan name used to describe former President Nelson Mandela, whose charismatic personality had a galvanizing effect on South African sports. By the time the World Cup came to South Africa, Mr. Mandela was ill and virtually housebound, making one brief appearance at the tournament final. A spokesman at the Nelson Mandela Foundation declined to comment on the indictment. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thanks, Anita. In more soccer news, the road to Rio and next year's Olympic men's football tournament continues this weekend in Africa. There will be qualifying matches across the continent. Our African football guru, David Legg, has an update for us. But first, David looks back at the most recent results.
First results, Ghana 1, Congo-Brazzaville 0, Sierra Leone 0, Cameroon 0, Mauritania 1, Mali 1, Botswana 1, Zambia 1, Rwanda 1, Uganda 2, Zimbabwe 0, Swaziland 0, and Tunisia 1, Sudan 0. The first thing that struck me about these results, Sonny, was the scarcity of goals. 9 goals in all in 7 matches, so it's an average of just over 1 a game. In fact, only one match, the match between Rwanda and Uganda in Kigali, produced what you would call an acceptable number of goals. There was 3 there, and I guess the Rwandan supporters, who were in the majority in Kigali, probably wished that there were a couple of goals less, because unfortunately 2 of those goals came to the Ugandans. The Ugandans took the lead, Rwanda leveled, and then Mutyaba, with 20 minutes left, gave the Ugandans a 2-1 victory. And with a whole match to come this weekend in Kampala, you would have to say the Ugandans are now favourites to advance to the third round, where they will play Egypt. Drama, Sonny, between Ghana and Congo, but not really on the field, off the field, in fact. Claude Leroy, the well-known Congo coach, was angry after the 1-0 victory for Ghana, claiming that several of the Ghanaian players were overage. He, in fact, called them cheats. Now, the Olympic tournament is for players under 23 years of age. And Leroy, who previously coached in Ghana, said that he knew several of the Ghanaian players and that there was no way that they were under 23 years of age. So that's something we're going to have to keep an eye on going forward. On the field of play, Ebo, who was brought in from the English club Port Vale, he scored the only goal on the stroke of half-time. So a tantalizing second leg coming up this weekend in Pointe Noire, with Congo Brazzaville seeking to overcome that one-goal deficit. Sierra Leone, because of the Ebola epidemic situation, they were forced to move their home match against Cameroon to Yaoundé in Cameroon, and they will be very pleased indeed that they held the Cameroonian Indomitable Cubs to a goalless draw. Another draw was in Mauritania, a late goal from Mali giving them a 1-1 draw. Yet another 1-1 draw came in Lobatse in Botswana, Zambia taking an early lead and Botswana levelling midway through the second half. The return match will be on Sunday in Lusaka, and you would have to say that Zambia are now clear favourites to win that tie. A surprise in Harare in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe only drawing 0-0 with Swaziland, normally Zimbabwean teams, either national or at club level, have the edge over the Swazis. But on this occasion, the Zimbabweans simply couldn't convert. Plenty of chances. And now the Swazis will fancy their chances in the return match. And the prize there for the winners is a matchup with South Africa. And another intriguing tie, Tunisia against Sudan, a goal right at the death, giving Tunisia a 1-0 lead. and they go to Sudan. So all those second leg matches, Sunny, coming up this weekend. And then if we look quickly at the draw, the winners between Ghana and Congo, they will face the dream team of Nigeria. The winners between Sierra Leone and Cameroon will face up against Algeria. Mauritania or Mali will play Gabon. And remember, Gabon won the last CAF Under-23 championship because these Olympic qualifiers, they also count towards the CAF Under-23 championship. Botswana or Zambia, the winners there will face Ivory Coast. Uganda or Rwanda, the winners will play Egypt. Zimbabwe or Swaziland will come up against South Africa. And either Tunisia or Sudan will face Morocco. A country we haven't mentioned are Senegal. They've got automatic place in the final competition, and that will be played in the second half of November and the first half of December. And when it's all done and dusted, there will be three African representatives at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
The National Basketball Association Finals tip off 1 week from today on June 4th in the western U.S. city of Oakland, California. The Golden State Warriors will host the Cleveland Cavaliers in Game 1 of the Best of 7 Championship Series. The Warriors reached the finals for the first time in 40 years with a 104-90 victory Wednesday night over the Houston Rockets. Golden State won the Western Conference Finals 4-1. The Warriors were once again led by league most valuable player Stephen Curry, who had 26 points and 8 rebounds.
Very, very proud and happy how we played tonight. Everybody on the court produced, made plays. The guys in here before me, HB, can't say enough about his performance tonight on both ends of the floor, stepping up in big moments. And it's just a proud moment for, I think, everybody in the Bay Area just to be 4 wins away from, you know, our goal.
That goal is the 4th championship in club history and the 2nd since the team moved from Philadelphia to California. While his players look ahead to next week's finals, Warriors coach Steve Kerr praises the vanquished opponent.
I just want to say congrats to Kevin McHale and the Rockets on a great season, a great series. They have a fantastic team. They are a handful to guard, and we're well aware that they had some injuries. They were a tough out, and other than Game 3, you know, every game was brutally difficult for us.
Will the NBA Finals be any easier for Steve Kerr and the Warriors? Well, they now go up against the Cavaliers squad led by LeBron James, who is playing in his 5th consecutive Finals. Many basketball fans are looking forward to seeing how LeBron, a 4-time NBA Most Valuable Player, does against Stephen Curry, the reigning MVP. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yeheyas Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, two residents talk about growing up in West Baltimore and what the recent riots means to them. And next, we will visit the Museum of Money in Johannesburg. But first, some music. It is Kamachi from Rwanda with Rua Gaspo.
Ye kukurata gakwi
Kamachi with Rua Gaspo.
Well, the riots in Baltimore, Maryland over the death of a black man in police custody highlighted the deep-rooted socioeconomic problems afflicting many American industrial cities over the past 50 years. VOA's Jeff Swicord spoke with two residents about growing up in West Baltimore and what the recent riots meant to them.
Me helping Deirdre.
Linda Keys is raising her three children where she grew up in Baltimore's Druid Heights.
That's me, my husband.
She says drugs, violence, and crime have always been a part of life in West Baltimore.
You really used to see shootouts, like literally, we really would have to be careful because I was caught up in a shootout before.
Deirdre, come over this way.
Linda rarely lets her children out of sight when they are outdoors. She hopes one day she can afford to move her family to a safer neighborhood.
I just want to change environments for my children where as though they don't have to go outside every day and see people maybe standing on the corner or just see people out there with drinks in their hand.
Her neighborhood, scarred with vacant housing, had a better past. It was once a thriving African-American middle-class community. Bronwyn Maiden is a social worker who grew up in West Baltimore.
That is a community where civil rights leaders were born. They went to school there. It's a neighborhood where many jazz greats, Billie Holiday, lived there, performed there.
News of the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King in April of 1968 led to an eruption of violence in Baltimore and in other American cities. Riots broke out along Baltimore's Pennsylvania Avenue, near where the recent disturbances took place.
After that riot, it became a scar in the city, right down the middle of West Baltimore.
From 1950 to 1995, the city lost 100,000 manufacturing jobs, 30,000 alone from Bethlehem Steel, once the largest steel plant in the country. More than 200,000 people left the city. Maiden says the loss of jobs and people crippled the West Baltimore neighborhood.
You could buy a house living if you worked at Beth Steel. Now, however, you have to have a college degree or even higher than a college, a graduate degree, if you're going to work in some of the top jobs places in Baltimore.
Maiden describes those who took part in the recent violence as children crying out for a better life.
They have been living in these housing projects and these homes with parents, some of whom are substance abusers, some of whom are in prison. And so out of all of that, you see the anger and the frustration, and they're asking us and demanding of us to help come up with some solutions.
Part of the solution, says Linda Keys, is parenting a generation of children with core values.
That's why I say it's not where you live, it's how you live. And I'm teaching my kids to not be like that. Go the other route. We're not going down this road.
Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Baltimore.
Johannesburg, a city built on the back of a gold rush and home to Africa's major stock exchange, has a monument to money. The Museum of Money is in a building belonging to the international banking group Barclays in the center of South Africa's biggest metropolis. Darren Taylor has more.
The beauty of money is you're dealing with items that have been used, and each coin has a history. It was in someone's hand. It was used for something.
Money Museum curator Dr. Paul Bayliss strolls past glass cabinets holding thousands of coins, from faded, chipped brass guilders brought to South Africa by Dutch settlers in the 1600s to dull, dark Portuguese coins recovered from a shipwreck off the Cape Coast in the 1400s.
Very large and almost unwieldy to work with when you think of currencies from most countries that now need to fit into your pocket.
Most old coins are big and very heavy. Bayliss holds one.
It's got a hole in the middle, allowing someone to put a bit of leather twine through that, hang it around their neck. It's not something you would really have carried in your pocket because of the weight.
The museum provides a record of the history of money dating back 4,500 years to when people exchanged commodities such as shells. Bayliss says ancient people bartered with anything they considered to be of value.
If we think of the San people, the ostrich eggshell was also quite an important item because that could be used for carrying water or storing water as they migrated.
The historian says the discovery of diamonds and gold in the mid to late 1800s had the greatest impact on the evolution of money in South Africa.
That brought in a whole new group of people into the country, and particularly then you would then also see the variety of coins that I will show you in the vault.
Inside the vault, overhead lights cause hundreds of brilliant coins to gleam. Armed security officers hover nearby, protecting the valuable collection. Inside are examples of some of the most famous coins in the world, South African Kruger Rands, made of pure gold. The coins bear the image of the long-bearded face of Paul Kruger, president of the South African Republic in the late 1800s.
The advantage of a Kruger Rand, it allows any individual to own a piece of gold. And from an investment perspective, it allows you to invest in actual gold.
One of the more unusual exhibits in the museum is what Baylis calls canvas sack money, used during the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902. But in assembling one of the greatest collections of money in the world, sourced from all over the globe, the impossible is exactly what Baylis and his colleagues have achieved. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. The World Health Organization has identified 17 of them as priorities for action. Some of them can be effectively treated and even eliminated with low-cost medications, in many cases donated by pharmaceutical companies. Getting these medications to where they are needed has been a daunting task, since these are diseases of the poorest of the poor. Their impact on individuals and communities can be devastating. NTDs impair intellectual development in children and reduce school enrollment. They limit the ability of infected individuals to work and thrive, thus trapping them in a cycle of poverty and disease. Today, over 1 billion people suffer from at least one NTD. In 2006, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, started a program addressing the seven diseases that comprise 80% of all NTDs: lymphatic filariasis, blinding trachoma, onchocerciasis, schistosomiasis, and the three most common infections, the soil-transmitted parasites hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm. Back then, the program had a budget of $15 million to distribute 36 million treatments to 16 million people in four countries, said USAID Assistant Administrator Ariel Pablos Mendez. Today, it's $100 million and 240 million treatments distributed to 115 million people in 31 countries. The program is very successful for three reasons. First is USAID's partnership with the pharmaceutical sector, which has to date contributed $8.8 billion worth of medication. Second is USAID's partnership and coordination with the government of the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, which has allowed for a collective reach to almost 50 countries and the provision of 340 million treatments in 2014. And third, USAID's cooperation with host governments and the ability to build upon the existing infrastructure of national disease control and elimination programs. The elimination of these diseases of extreme poverty as a public health scourge is within our grasp, said USAID Assistant Administrator Pablos Mendez. USAID is committed to working with countries and our global partners to reach the remaining 800 million people who still need treatment.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.